So here's the question. The economic recovery is almost 6 years along. How much longer? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, the 13th of November. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. It might not feel like it right now, but it is entirely possible that we are going to look back at this very week and go, huh, that's when the economy started cooling off. Not saying it's definite here, but it could be. Here to discuss, to agree or disagree, vociferously or not, about the week that was, we've got Neela Richardson from Redfin, also Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so Neela, I'm going to start with you. What do you think of my basic premise? We had global economic cooling this week. People are upset. Retail sales are down. Stock market's utsy. What do you think?
There's a tangled mess of economic data. It's very circular, you know. There's a lot of global uncertainty that feeds into a stronger dollar, which feeds into lower oil prices, lower gas prices. But does that mean more consumer spending? All of these things are related. And So it's really hard to disentangle where we are. But what it seems like is there is a cooling going on.
Sudeep, agree, disagree?
It certainly is the case that we're cooling, and we've been cooling for a while. Yeah. This might be the moment where all of our warnings have really come up to the surface. Retail sales, after everything we've expected for the last year, that cheap gasoline would make consumers happy and make them go out and spend, that's just proving not to be the case. And when you see months and months of weak retail sales in this kind of environment, you have to wonder what's going on.
Neela, what do we think consumers are doing with the money, right? Because oil is down. I mean, that's one of the things we're looking at, right? Oil is down to 40-something dollars, which is pretty low. Commodities are really low. What are consumers doing with the money?
They're paying their rent, Kai. I mean, the cost of housing has grown astronomically. It's the one thing in all of this where we can't say that it's below expectation. And I think a lot of people are doing the very simple thing of finding a place to live and paying for it with that extra gas money.
Sudeep, how long is it going to take before this starts showing up in the numbers? I mean, we've seen GDP readings slowing down. Job market, though, is doing pretty well. There's a little bit of a disconnect at the macro level, right?
There's a huge disconnect between what we're seeing in consumer spending and what we're seeing in the labor market. The big missing piece is still wage growth. We've seen some uptick in wage growth, and maybe that's the reason why consumers aren't feeling all that much better with stronger job growth and with gas prices where they are.
Okay, but wait. And I went round and round with this with Lynette last week. In the jobs report that came out last week, wages are up, Neela, 2.5% year over year. It's not great, but they're growing.
You know, 1 month of growth, year over year growth, does not a trend make. We've had several months of stagnation, and it takes a while to climb out of a hole. We're a little bit up higher, but we haven't seen a big increase. And if one of the big costs, the cost of housing, whether purchase or renting, has increased, it's going to take a while for consumers to really, really rebound. It's not going to happen overnight.
I appreciate the irony here, Sudeep, given how I started the show and my premise for this discussion. But how much of what's going to happen with consumers will be driven by mood? When they see, let's say, Macy's this week coming out with lousy profit forecasts, lousy expectations for the holidays, and then they get nervous, right? It's a confidence and sentiment thing.
They do get nervous, but consumers have been nervous for a long time. It's been more than 6 years since the recession ended. A lot of people still have a recessionary mindset. Nobody believes the recovery, and it's going to take a lot more to believe the recovery. But if you have a lot of these gauges moving in the wrong direction, particularly internationally and with volatility in markets, all of this stuff starts to weigh on people, even if they see some improvement. So you have to see a lot more improvement to offset some of the negative factors.
And not just people, not just consumers, businesses too. They're part of this too. And investment hasn't been where we need it to be to see real growth in the economy.
Can we just pause here for a minute to remark that we're talking about people and companies not believing the recovery is real, and we are almost 6 years into it, Neela, right?
Right. Well, there's several reasons. We're still acting policy-wise like it's not real. We're still in an artificially stimulated economy. There's no indication other than a really strong jobs report after a really not-so-strong jobs report that things are really improving in a way that is a long-term trend and not just a short-term blip up.
And some businesses are really just watching the clock to see whether we're coming to the end of the recovery. Most recoveries are going to last five or six years. They don't last longer than 10 years. So people are getting cautious again and trying to brace for whatever could be ahead, whether it's due to something globally or due to something domestically.
We got through that whole thing without saying the words Janet Yellen, Federal Reserve, or interest rates. I am collectively proud of us, I have to tell you. Sudeep Reddy from The Wall Street Journal, Neela Richardson from Redfin. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
All right, have a good weekend, everybody. On Wall Street today, no way, not happening, nope. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A word now about the economics of geopolitics, or what foreign policy types like to call force projection. The United States Navy and the Air Force, as you may have seen in the news of late, have been taking some trips out to the South China Sea. Last month, an American destroyer passed within 12 nautical miles of an island built up by Chinese engineers. This week, the U.S. flew two bombers out near another artificial island. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains it's all about rules and power and, oh yeah, money.
If I am a rock in the middle of the sea, I have rights under international law.
Rocks that cannot sustain human habitation are entitled to a 12 nautical mile territorial sea, as well as the airspace above the territorial sea.
This is James Kraska, professor of international law at the U.S. Naval War College. Now, if I am a fancy rock, a rock that people can actually live on, also known as an island, I get fancy rights.
And islands may generate a 200-mile exclusive economic zone.
Meaning I have the right to all the fishing, all the mining, all the oil, 200 miles out. Now, if I am not an island, and not even a rock, if I am literally just a sad sandbar or a fake island made out of sand and concrete, which is what China has been building, I get pretty much nothing.
Only entitled to a 500-meter safety zone.
These are the rules under international law. China has different rules in mind.
Completely divorced from the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea.
Gregory Poling is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Even though China signed on to the Law of the Sea, its claims boil down to this is ours, which is why the U.S. keeps sailing or flying by, to say the rules the rest of the world plays by allow us to be here, so here we are. There's a ton riding on whose rules prevail. Harry Scheiber directs UC Berkeley's Law of the Sea Institute.
The possibility of enormous resources of oil and gas in that area.
Two other resources at play here, rule of law and nationalism, both priceless. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Lest you think China is the only country interested in writing its own laws of the sea, think again. The United States has its own peculiar history of island grabbing. It's a story told on the podcast that we do with Quartz. Sabri hosts, along with Quartz's Tim Fernholz. Check it out. It's actually pretty good. You can get it on iTunes, on your podcast provider of choice. If you like, it is called Actuality. All right, moving on. We all know that banks and other lenders look at credit reports to figure out what interest rate you're going to pay on something, everything from car loans to mortgages. But those scores are finding their way into all kinds of calculations, including lately cell phone providers and cable companies using them to set fees and prices. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that story.
It's called risk-based pricing, and companies are required to notify customers when they use it. Recently, the cell phone provider Sprint settled with the Federal Trade Commission for almost $3 million.
This is our second risk-based pricing rule case in less than 2 years.
Matthew Wilshire is a lawyer for the FTC. Now, Sprint didn't admit any wrongdoing in the case. It involved how Sprint notified subprime customers being charged an extra $8 a month. Wilshire says companies using this type of pricing have to tell you why you're being charged more.
The notice should include information about where they got your credit score from and why your credit score might have been lower than it otherwise would be.
That notice can tip consumers off to check their credit report. Ed Merzwinski is with the U.S. Public Research Interest Group. He says this type of pricing is becoming more common.
Years and years ago, a credit report was used to make a yes-no decision. Now more and more consumers pay based on their credit score, and everybody might pay a different amount.
But sometimes credit reports and scores can be misleading and riddled with errors. Pamela Banks is with Consumers Union. She says when companies don't fully explain things, customers just see a higher bill.
And so consumers are faced with these charges, but unfortunately, they don't even know it's happening.
Banks and the FTC say read the fine print. And if there's a fee you don't understand on a monthly bill, ask. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We were down in Tuscaloosa, Alabama a couple of weeks ago to kick off our economic coverage of next year's presidential election. And one of the things we mentioned was that the economy there seemed to be humming right along. In point of fact, though, what's going on in Tuscaloosa is all the more remarkable because a bit less than 5 years ago, April of 2011, to be a little bit more precise, a huge tornado ripped through that city. More than 50 people died. Estimates are 12% of the city was simply destroyed and 7,000 people lost their jobs. Stan Engold of Alabama Public Radio takes a look at what recovery's been like.
On April 27, 2011, I was eating lunch at a barbecue restaurant on 15th Street in the middle of Tuscaloosa. Little did I know that just a few hours later, a tornado would cut through that area filled with homes, businesses, and many trees that helped Tuscaloosa earn the nickname the Druid City. The storm leveled nearly everything I could see from that restaurant window. Here's restaurant owner Brad McDaniel.
When I walked out of the restroom that day from the tornado, I looked across Forest Lake and I thought thousands of people in Tuscaloosa were dead because all the trees, the beautiful trees that were over there were like twigs.
Today, McDaniel owns the barbecue restaurant Who's Q, located on the same spot as his old business that was wrecked by the storm.
I mean, nothing was left. It was literally like a bomb had gone off in Tuscaloosa.
He reopened soon after in Northport, just across the Black Warrior River.
We did a temporary location. I did have some customers that would come eat with us, but it just wasn't like the location on 15th Street.
So he came back to his old location, but this time he wasn't part of a franchise.
It was time for me to get out or renew it for 5 more years, so I decided to get out, and when we reopened, I reopened under a new name.
And he reopened 2 years to the day after the storm. But he's had to work to lure back his customers.
It's just hard to let everybody know that used to come see us because I didn't know where they were and they hadn't seen us in 2 years.
McDaniel says business is growing every day and he's happy with his decision to come back. Today the city has rebuilt much of what was destroyed, but you can still see where the tornado cut its path in some places. Tuscaloosa Mayor Walter Maddox had this to say about a year out from the storm.
I believe our future is even brighter. But it's still a long journey. There's going to be many bumps in the road, and there is, as I tell most groups that ask, there's no easy way out of this.
And there was no easy way out for Deborah Burrows and her family business, H&W Drugs.
It's hard to see, but it says H&W Drugs East on the roof. Well, that H&W that was there is what's in my backyard now.
Wow.
And it was next door in the parking lot of the Schlotsky's next door.
Burroughs shows me pictures of the business her father built back in 1964. Today, the lot where the drugstore stood is empty, but when you walk up, you can still see the floor tiles that read H&W Drugs. For Burroughs, it still holds a lot of memories, and the decision to not come back was a tough one.
All our customers were just an extended family, and I cried a lot to try to decide whether I wanted to build back, and because I just felt like I was letting down a lot of people. I'm sorry. But really, it pretty much came down to a business decision.
And there was a lot to think about.
With health care and all the third parties that are paying for medications and paying for things, each year the profit margin shrinks, what you're able to make on your prescriptions. There's competition to lower your front-end prices to compete with all the other big box stores that sell things discounted every day.
Burroughs says she had to think of her employees as well.
The employees couldn't stand not having a job for 3 or 4 months while this all got figured out. And, you know, it was a hard decision, and I came to the decision that I would not reopen.
Burroughs continues as a pharmacist, but now she works for someone else. The city of Tuscaloosa is still figuring out how to commemorate the 5th anniversary of the 2011 tornado. in Tuscaloosa, I'm Stan Ingold for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So at one point, we had a transportation system that had horses, and the horses made horse ploppies.
It's a story about global warming. Seriously, it is. But first, let's do the numbers. There they are. The Dow Industrial's off 202 points today. 1.5% closed at 17,245. The NASDAQ down 77 points, 1.5%, finished at 49.27. The S&P 500 shed 22 points, 1.1%. Ended 2023. I just like the way they sound, those trombones. For the week, the Dow gave back 3.7%. The NASDAQ off 4.3%. The S&P 500 sliced off 3.6% itself. Lower third quarter earnings continue for retailers, as we were talking about up in the wrap. Nordstrom cut its outlook for the year. The stock refunded nearly 15% today, 1.5%. JCPenney reported better than expected sales, but still the stock declined 15.3%. Bond prices, though, rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.27%. You're listening to Marketplace. If you miss something on the air, you can hit our podcast. The link is at marketplace.org or try our Facebook page, Marketplace APM. Like us, comment to us, whatever you want. Just let us know you're there. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is getting expensive to be in the streaming video business these days, especially if you're trying to take on the big guns. That'd be Amazon and Netflix, of course. That brings us to today's big entertainment industrial complex news, courtesy of the Wall Street Journal. The paper says Hulu is in talks to sell off 25% of itself to Time Warner. Marketplace's Sally Herships has that story.
If this supposed deal becomes a deal,
the big advantage would be for Hulu.
Mike Farrell is a senior editor with Multichannel News. The company would be valued at $5 billion and sitting on a lot more cash, which it could use to pay for content.
Hulu is expanding into original content. They're doing, you know, they have a comedy casual. They picked up the Mindy Project. They've got something called Difficult People.
Creating original content, especially the kind that can compete with House of Cards and Orange is the New Black, is pricey. And so is licensing existing shows. Neil Macker is an analyst with Morningstar. He says there's another reason Hulu could use more money, to give it more leverage against the competition.
And it'd also allow the company to better bid on content against both Amazon Prime and Netflix.
Hulu says it has nearly 9 million subscribers. Some pay a fee, some don't. Hulu's hook is giving subscribers shows from networks and cable within just a few days after they air. The company also brings in advertising dollars. But is Time Warner interested in a deal?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't think we've seen any confirmation or any reports confirming that Time Warner is, in fact, interested.
Greg Ireland is an analyst with IDC, a global analysis firm. Hulu didn't respond to a request for comment, and NBC, Fox, and Disney aren't talking either. But before any deal could go through, they'd have to agree to seeing their stakes in the company drop from a third to a quarter. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
A couple of days after Thanksgiving, negotiators from pretty much every country on the planet are going to gather for a big United Nations conference on global warming. If everything works as planned, they're going to lock in the pledges that each country has made, countries including China, including the United States, pledges they have made to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's a big deal. So over the next couple of weeks, we're going to do a bunch of stories about climate change to set up what is going to be happening at that conference. We're going to tell you about the behavioral economics of it, the stuff that helps explain why it's so hard to deal with a threat as big as global warming is, and why it's so hard for countries to believe what other countries promise to do about it. We're going to tell you how much the energy world has changed since the last big UN conference, Copenhagen, 6 years ago, a meeting that generally failed to make any progress. But first today, Marketplace's Scott Tong has the tale of how we as a planet got to where we are in a changing climate and how much longer we as a society have to fix it. Here's Scott.
Modern energy takes you places. It refrigerates our food, powers the device you're listening to right now. And most of the time, energy also makes waste. It always has.
So at one point, we had a transportation system that had horses, and the horses made horse ploppies.
Penn State geologist Richard Alley says today's waste is carbon dioxide.
If our CO2 came out of the car as horse ploppies, it would sort of be a pound per mile. And if you put that on the roads of America, in a year, it would average an inch deep.
So how much waste is too much? Here's another analogy. Imagine our atmosphere is a landfill. Better yet, a landfill in New Jersey, near Princeton, where I found Oxford physicist Raymond Pierre Humbert.
Right now, we're using the atmosphere as a free and unregulated waste dump for carbon dioxide, and we've been doing that for a long time.
Here's the key science. Don't just focus on the trucks dumping the waste. That's the rate of emissions. Focus on the heap. Total cumulative carbon stays in the atmosphere for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years, trapping heat.
Really, the one knob you have to pay attention to that actually determines how warm it's going to get is cumulative carbon emissions.
Picture the landfill holding a trillion tons of carbon. That's likely enough to turn up global temps by about 2 degrees Celsius. Again, Richard Alley.
That's 3.6 Fahrenheit, and the land warms more than the ocean, so that's 4 or 5 or a bit more Fahrenheit where most of us live.
At that point, scientists say extreme events, weather patterns, crop yields, they go beyond what we know. The bigger the rise, the bigger the risk. So, how'd we get here? 18th century steam engines enabled the 19th century of machines and railroads, and the early steam came from burning a magical source of dense energy, coal. Thus, the first truckloads of carbon waste started to dump into our landfill. It actually didn't take too long for scientists to start understanding the idea of carbon waste. Science historian Naomi Oreskes says in 1896, a Swedish chemist named Svante Arrhenius published a paper.
He's the first scientist who points out that when you burn fossil fuels, it emits carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and this has the potential to warm the climate. So the basic physics and chemistry of this is very old, very well established. It's more than a century old.
He didn't get it all right. Arrhenius thought warming might take about 500 years, because back then there was hardly any trash in the landfill. Even the horseless carriage, that would be the car, didn't really speed things up too much. A full decade after the Model T, the landfill was 9% full.
Not much actually happened in that first 100 years. It's actually surprising how little total carbon dioxide was released in that first 100 years compared to what happens later.
Later, as in post-World War II. Many scientists call this the Great Acceleration, a boom in all kinds of things. Population, GDP, urbanization, energy use.
It's mobility, it's electricity use, it's the size of our houses.
Fossil fuels lit those homes and heated them, and powered ships and trucks to deliver food long distances to those homes. By now, if you're feeling guilty, don't. Richard Alley at Penn State doesn't.
Rather than picking out one thing and say, wow, if we just hadn't invented the car, we'd have had something else, because we're clever and we love the good we get from the energy we use.
And back in the 1950s and 60s, we were just starting to measure and detect emissions in the atmosphere. Science papers started to inform people like President Lyndon Johnson.
Now my natural beauty message is going up Monday.
In this scratchy phone call tape, LBJ tells an advisor about a report that's going to Congress. It read, "This generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere through a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels." By then, 1965, the landfill was a quarter full.
Now, no one in 1965 thought that climate change was already underway.
That is, yes, we had emissions. No, there wasn't consensus on actual warming. Naomi Oreskes says it took till 1995, 20 years ago, for a high-level science panel to announce temperature rise and a discernible human influence. By now, more trucks were dumping more waste in the landfill than ever before. But even then, it was mostly waste from the rich countries. Oreskes says emerging economies didn't really crash the trash party until 2000. And did they ever? So today,
we are roughly half full,
says Oxford's Ray Pierre Humbert.
But because the usage of fossil fuels has grown so much since then, it won't take another 200 years or so to fill it up the rest of the way. At the current rate, we will fill up that trillion-ton limit somewhere around 2030.
That is the incredible fill rate that climate negotiators from around the world are racing against as they prepare for the next round of talks in Paris. And from a science perspective, the point is not just to slow the dumping, but eventually bring it to zero. In Princeton, New Jersey, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final thought on the way out today. This has been, as you know, a horrible day in Paris, France. President Obama has made a statement at the White House. French President François Hollande, who was evacuated from that country's main sports stadium near the earliest of the attacks, has gone on French TV. He's declared a state of emergency. France's borders will be closed, though for how long, we don't know. Things over there are still developing. More later on this public radio station. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 202 points on this Friday, about 1.1%. The NASDAQ down 77 points, 1.5%. The S&P 500 off 22 points, 1.1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a good weekend, everybody. Give a thought to those folks over in Paris, huh? We'll see you Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.